indeed the schus to bring tonight's esteemed group of Rabbanim, Dayanim, Askanim before us. We are discussing a very important topic. In Yonai Tzava B'Yerusha, yet the number of experts are limited. Our first discussant is a musmach from Yitzchak Elchanan, a graduate of Yale Law School, worked in corporate law, and now is the Menahel of the Beis Din of America, Rabbi Yonah Reese.
Touch my comments this evening on some of the general issues relating to the halachas of wills and inheritance according to halacha. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Most people know that there is a common practice that people leave aside wills so that when they reach Meir Esrim Shana, and it comes time to pass on in the world, that there be some orderly process by which their possessions will be given over to their descendants, to their relatives, to the other people and causes that they deem worthy for their possessions to go. However, what not everybody realizes is that there are halachos, there are Jewish law principles that apply to how one is and is not permitted to bequeath one's possessions and the manner in which one is supposed to go about performing a will in the first place. With respect to many different areas of monetary law, we apply the principle of dina d'malchusa dina, that people can follow basically the laws of the land in deciding how to conduct their monetary affairs, if they should so stipulate. If somebody decides, two people enter into a transaction and they want a contract, that basic principles of the modern marketplace will govern their affairs, they're generally permitted to do so, so long as they do not violate any laws of issa v'heter, of ritual prohibition, such as ribbis, the prohibition against taking usury, for example. However, when it comes to the area of tzava, of making out a will, the poskim point out very pointedly from the times of the Rishonim, the Rashba, the Rambam, to the Achronim, the Ksam Sofer, and others, that dina d'malchusa dina most pointedly does not apply to the area of wills. That there are halachos, that the Torah says that the area of nachala, of who inherits your money, is called, as the Rambam puts it, it's in the Torah, but the Rambam emphasizes, it's called a chukas mishpat. It's called something which is a chukah, a law which you're not allowed to divert from, you're not allowed to stray from, and therefore the halachos of what you can and cannot do are very narrowly circumscribed. The Gemara says that you're not allowed to take away from people who would inherit you according to Torah law and give your possessions to people who would not inherit you according to Torah law. That's called the avure akasanta. That's called passing over your inheritance from those the Torah says should inherit to those who are not designated as heirs or not designated as inheritors. In fact, the Torah has a very detailed sequence of how a person's assets are supposed to be allocated. We know that in America, if a person dies intestate, they haven't made a will, their assets automatically go a certain way. If they have sons and daughters, then the assets get split between the sons and the daughters. If a man has a wife, the assets go to a wife. In Torah law, the divisions are different. When a man dies and he leaves his wife, all of his assets don't automatically go to his wife. The ksuba stipulates that a certain amount is set aside to take care of the wife, that she for her medical expenses and food expenses and so forth. But the general principle is that a man's assets, as well as a woman's assets, go directly to their sons. If there are sons and daughters, it actually only goes to sons. I'm not making this up. This is in the Torah. If there are no sons, then it goes to the daughters. If there were sons and the sons died and the sons had grandchildren, then it would go to the grandchildren of the sons before it would go to the daughters, etc., etc., etc. Now, the our Chachamim realized that people will sometimes want to establish that some of their assets go to other people as well. So how is this? How is a person allowed to do it? Well, they are allowed to do it under certain circumstances. But those circumstances are very limited halakhically, and you have to really know what halakhically you can and cannot do. Halakhically, you're always allowed to give a gift when you're still alive. You're allowed to, in the middle of your life, take $10,000 and say, I'm going to give $10,000 to a friend of mine, even though they're not someone who would inherit you, according to the Torah. The real problem is when you say that I want to bequeath when I die certain possessions. So then the halakha is that unless a person's on his deathbed, that a person is not allowed to take from his rightful heirs and give to somebody else. If a person is on his deathbed, he's what we call a shchiv meira. So a shchiv meira, according to the Gemara, is allowed to say that I have two sons, is once, but both of them would get equal amounts. Let's say neither of them is a bechor. The eldest son generally gets a portion, two portions as much as the other sons. Let's say the first child was a daughter. So you have two sons. They both would get equal amounts. But I'm going to give 90% to one son and 10% to the other son. So if a person is on his deathbed, he's allowed to do this, even though he's doing this as he's bequeathing his possessions. He's doing it as part of a will. But he's only allowed to do it from one rightful heir to another rightful heir, and he's only allowed to do it on his deathbed. So realistically speaking, most people aren't going to be writing their wills on their deathbed. They're going to be writing their wills when they're relatively healthy. In fact, there's a sefer called Chaim Ubracha that writes that a person, when he reaches the age of 50, should sit down and write some sort of tzava, some sort of document, a will document, establishing how he wants his assets to be handled after his death, and how he wants his children to behave after his death. So how does one do it then? According to halacha, you're not allowed to take away from your rightful heirs. But we said that you are allowed to give gifts. So if a person writes his will halachically in such a way that it would be construed as a gift, then it would be an acceptable document under certain guidelines. The problem is that you can't give a gift halakhically that will not take effect until after your death. This is a separate problem. This isn't a problem simply of that it's prohibited. This is a problem of that it doesn't work. Since we've already established that dina de mahusa dina, the law of the land, doesn't apply in the area of wills, you can't rely on the fact that the law of the land says that such a kinyan, such a transaction would work. There is one minority opinion that says that you can rely upon that, but the majority of opinions say that you can't. So how do you provide for overcoming this obstacle? So the way that you do it is by, number one, finding a lawyer who will make sure that you do a will properly, according to secular law, because after all, you do want a document that's going to be enforceable, and you have certain ideas about how you want your assets to be disposed. Problem is, okay, I can't give away a gift. If I have it as a, if I say that I'm doing this as a Yerusha, that this is how I'm bequeathing my possessions, then you violated the prohibition of bequeathing your possessions not according to halakha, unless you're giving it exactly according to exactly to the people and in the percentages established by halakha. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that even if you gave it over as a gift, you can't have a gift that's going to take effect after your death. So the way to do it is to sign, and I gave out some forms. It's actually a very short form, and a very easy way of overcoming these problems is that you sign what's known as a shtar hischayvus, a document of indebtedness, in which you identify the people to whom you want your possessions to go, who are not heirs under the Torah. Let's say you want to give to a couple of cousins who wouldn't have inherited, you want to give to your daughters who wouldn't inherit, when you have sons and daughters, and you want the daughters to get as well as to the sons. And you say, you figure out that you're not going to have more than $1 million when you die, okay? Or $5 million or whatever it is. And you say, I hereby obligate myself to pay $10 million or $20 million, some ridiculous sum that you know you're not going to have at that point in time. If it turns out you win the lottery, you can always revise it later and multiply it by the appropriate amount. But in normal circumstances, if it's, you know, $10 million, something like that, you're not going to have that amount. So the effect of this indebtedness is that all of your money at the time that you die is going to have to go to this person. And you stipulate that this gift is not going to take a place right now because you don't want to give away all of your money right now. And this gift is not going to take place after you die because then it would be too late and it wouldn't be good, halakhically speaking. But this gift will be good 1 minute before I die. Say, you can do that. You can say, I am hereby obligating myself that I am going to give this gift, and this gift will take effect 1 minute before I die. However, you throw in a caveat. What's the caveat? The caveat is, I wrote a document which is called a will, which secular law recognizes as a will, and if my heirs, the people who should rightfully inherit me, follow the terms of that will, then I will cancel this indebtedness and they will not be obligated to pay this indebtedness. Because otherwise the effect is that your heirs will inherit this indebtedness. If they get $1 million from the estate, they'll have to take that $1 million and give it to this other person. Let's say the other person is one of your daughters. You have two sons and one daughter. And you say, I obligate myself to give $2 million to my daughter. So then when you die, halakhically speaking, the $2 million go to your sons. Let's say you have $1 million, it goes to your sons, and your sons would have to take all the money and give it to the daughter, so they have a way out of it. If they follow the will, which says, whatever it'll say that she gets a third and each of the brothers get a third, whatever it'll say, even though halakhically it wouldn't ordinarily be that way, but that they are on their own deciding that they're going to follow the terms of the will in order to escape this indebtedness. So the person himself is not bequeathing the terms of the will to the various parties. The person himself is just obligating himself, so we call him matanis bari, a gift of a healthy person to pay a certain indebtedness, but his heirs have the option of getting out of it if they follow a certain condition. So that is halakhically valid because he's not bequeathing these amounts. He's simply giving, he's right now obligating himself to pay a stipulated amount, and he's giving his heirs the out as to how to get out of that certain amount. Now, once that document is executed, the only problem is, okay, great. So now we've solved the halakhic problem, and Rabbi Welch will go further into all the details of the halakhas behind this, which I'm just touching upon in a very general fashion. But now we've gotten out of the halakhic problem because we have a will document, and we also have the separate document of indebtedness which solves the halakhic problems. Okay? But the problem is, what kind of effect is this document of indebtedness going to have from a secular law perspective? You have to worry. You have this document that says that you're obligated to pay $2 million. Let's say that the person who's entitled to that money tries to enforce it. Well, let's say that we have to worry that maybe the tax authorities will consider this to be imputed income, and they'll even impute interest income on this amount that you're obligating yourself to pay this third party. Or maybe even if it's your daughter, or let's say they'll consider it like a gift and they'll charge gift tax on it. Or when the indebtedness is forgiven, they'll say, okay, when the indebtedness was forgiven, then there should be relief of indebtedness income, which should accrue to the heirs who would otherwise be obligated to pay this amount of the indebtedness. So these are important concerns from a secular law perspective. The best way to get out of it, and this is consistent with the prevalent secular law in New York, is that if the parties throw in a lot of Hebrew mumbo-jumbo and lingo in this document, making it clear that it's only being executed for purposes of complying with halakha, for purposes of complying with the Jewish law, then courts will generally, even if they get a hold of this document, construe it as such and not assign any kind of a secular law interpretation to or consequence to the document. The document could even go further, according to some poskim, according to some authorities, although this form doesn't have that kind of language, that says that if there is any question as to secular law purposes, as to which document should govern, then the secular law will shall govern in terms of construing the consequences for secular law purposes, which according to some poskim is okay because halakhically you're doing what you're supposed to do, but you want it to have a certain consequence from a secular law perspective. Number three, you don't have to have secular law authorities even see this document. It doesn't have to be signed by both parties. It could just be signed by the testator himself, that he's obligating himself to pay a certain sum of money, and then it can be deposited with the local rabbi, and the local rabbi can just keep it in his files without it having to be submitted to probate with the rest of the documents. So that halakhically you did what you were supposed to do, but you don't have to have this document intertwined with the secular will for purposes of possibly messing you up from a secular law perspective. The final point that that I'll make is that, and I'm sure Rabbi Welcher will probably develop upon this theme and other themes as well, is that even if you do everything in a halakhically correct fashion, so that basically what you're giving away is a gift as opposed to bequeathing an inheritance, which to parties that shouldn't get it according to halakha, so that by virtue of giving a gift with a condition out, as I've described, you circumvent the halakhic problems, there is a separate prohibition, which is that even if you do everything correctly, the Gemara says that you're not supposed to do things in so clever a way that you take away the Torah scheme of inheritance entirely. That there should always be a certain amount that you leave, and it should be more than just a nominal amount, which is disposed of in complete concordance with the halakhic scheme of who gets what. So that, for example, if the halakha says you have two sons and you have a son, a grandson from another son, and two daughters. So halakhically speaking, the son gets 50%, and the grandson from the second son, who let's say had passed away young, would get the other 50%. Then you should set aside a sum of $1,000 or some significant amount, which will be disposed of completely 100% according to the laws of how the Torah would dispose of money that's left intestate, that is left to be inherited. In order that the laws of the set forth by the Torah, in terms of how one should leave their inheritance, not be completely ignored, even through all of these otherwise permissible devices. Since I see that I've run over time a little bit, I'll conclude there. And any points that are not completely covered by all the speakers, obviously you can ask about afterwards.
Thank you very much.
When I began planning tonight's program, I did a lot of research and asked around who should be called, who is the expert. The name that consistently came up is Rabbi Welcher. It's an honor to introduce to you an experienced lecturer, Rav, Dayan, and friend, Rabbi Welcher.
Thank you, Ruvi. Good evening, everyone. I wanted to turn my attention to amplify a little bit on the remarks of Rabbi Ries, and also to share with you a little from practical experience the consequences of not doing things the right way. Experience has taught me, and it's become a catchword of mine when people come to consult me on this subject, and I tell them very simply, if you hate your children, don't write a book. And the family feuding which will take place if God forbid one dies without leaving a will, we will absolutely assure that there will be no family harmony for generations to come. And this sometimes under the best of circumstances and with the best of intentions. I was involved in a situation about 2 or 3 years back. There was a person who was a rather elderly businessman who stayed in business till close to the time of his death. He was very, very elderly. And one of his sons was involved with him in business. The rest of the family had their own pursuits. And consequently, at the time of his passing, a very large proportion of his assets were in the trust of this particular son. Now the nature of the business, the nature of the fact that this son was involved in the business, there was no really precise accounting of the assets that were involved. It was a person that had many, many business interests. And despite the fact that I believe that the family, in fact, does have some degree of understanding of what he wanted done, and they weren't disputing that, but the dispute centered around what was exactly was included in the estate and how large the estate was. And there was no accounting of any assets whatsoever. And consequently, a family which had lived in harmony for many, many decades is torn asunder by a very, very difficult family feud. And this is not the first time that I've seen it. That is very, very striking. It's another situation that I'm aware of. There was a person that was responsible for a large organization. He was its president and chief executive officer. And one son worked with him for many, many years in the business. And despite his advanced years, he never actually got around to writing a will. He drafted a will. Finally, near the end of his life, he had the will brought to him, but he couldn't actually bring himself to sign the will. Well, what disturbed him, he was concerned that in light of the fact that one of his sons was the one that had worked with him all of these years, obviously he was deserving of a disproportionate share of the business, and he'd invested his life in the business. And in many years, when his father was elderly and infirm, he actually ran the business. And people had almost forgotten that there was an elderly father that was, in fact, the president and chief executive officer of this business. So obviously, he was one that deserved quite a disproportionate share. But nevertheless, to actually sign this document, he was afraid it would cause feuding among his children. Because, in effect, he favored one over the other. And he kept delaying it, delaying it, delaying it. And one fine day, he didn't wake up. And the document was still remained on his table unsigned. And the document is now figured in quite a few rounds of litigation concerning what exactly he wanted. Those that argued, this was obviously, he had it drafted by his lawyers, this is obviously what he wanted. And the others said, well, quite just as obviously he didn't sign it. So he never decided to put it into effect. And it's a very, very vicious dispute. And it's these types of situations which cause us to feel that it's very, very important to deal with the subject that we're not always comfortable dealing with. Mortality is not an issue any of us wish to face, but is the inevitable consequence of living in this world. If we're to search the entire world with 5 billion of its people, I don't believe that we'll find one human being that's 140 years old. So basically, everyone that was born in the year 1860 is no longer living. So we can rest assured that all of us are going to have to come to peace with that particular aspect of human existence. And if we spend the time to think about it, there are a lot of issues, both halachic issues and practical issues, which need to be thought through. Just to mention a number of the halachic issues. I mean, the halachic system is one where the halachic system of will, if in a situation where there are sons and daughters, halachically, the daughters, the sons are the ones who receive the entire estate, the daughters do not. And this was a situation which caused great concern among rabbinic circles in the last many centuries because of the fact that if a father lived to the ripe old age of 80 and all his children were well established in the world, it was less an issue. People often died young as well, especially in the centuries back, and they left very young children, and they left unmarried daughters, and it was necessary to provide for them to make sure that in the difficulty of the mother attempting to sustain the family as a widow, that this young woman would be able to get started in life. And that's why they created the document described by Rabbi Ries. That was the initial purpose it was created for. It was called the Shtar Chatzi Zohar, where they gave a half of a shir in the will to each unmarried female. And it is this particular document that contemporary halachic authorities have used to bring about the possibility of transferring one's estate to one's children in a manner which would not violate the halacha. Now, we have to be very concerned not only with the halachic aspects, but with the secular law aspects as well. And I'm not only concerned with the lawyerly parts, the lawyers can worry about the lawyerly parts, but we have to face the fact that we have a very Western orientation. We personally and our children have a very Western orientation. And the consideration by people of what is just and unjust has very much to do with our sense of orientation. If I expect something, if I expect to be paid in a certain way and I'm not, I consider it unjust. If throughout our entire society we consider that a person that performed a certain job should be paid a certain way and he's not, then we would collectively pronounce judgment that it's unjust. Our children expect, due to the nature of the Western society in which we live, that to the largest extent we will not differentiate between them on the basis of gender when it comes to the matter of the estate. And if we do, it is so much become a part of the psychology of people that I will share with you a situation that occurred not here, in perhaps the most westernized Jewish community that one would find in the world. But this actually happened in Old Yerushalayim in the last 20 years or so, where a man died, and he left only a halachic will, and he had two sons. And they intended to go to the Beis Din in Jerusalem and enforce the will. They had one living sister, and they went, before they attempted to enforce the will, to consult with a Hasidic rabbi in Jerusalem, and he warned them that they should not attempt to enforce the will and disenfranchise their sister, and that they would have very severe consequences practically if they try to do it. And he suggested to them that they make a significant settlement with her, not necessarily one which would have given her an entire share, which her father did not leave to her, but give her a significant share, and that way they would bring about a harmonious and peaceful resolution of this family situation. People don't give up on money so quickly, and they don't trust other people's wisdom too readily when it comes to their money. And consequently, they decided that they were wiser than this Hasidic rabbi, and they went to Beis Din and they attempted to enforce the will. But much to their surprise, and this woman is a member of the very Orthodox community of Jerusalem, she went to the secular court in Jerusalem to file a suit against them that she wanted the will probated according to the secular law of the state of Israel. So now, not only are you getting perhaps a half of what she would have, a fifth of the assets, she would now wind up with a third of the assets. So if we try to be too wise and decide we're going to ignore the secular context in which we live, we're also unlikely to produce an effect which is going to be harmonious among our children. And that's really what's created the difficulty in this area, that we as halachic Jews, as Torah Jews, wish to maintain fidelity to the halacha, but yet we do not want to bring disharmony into our family in the future. There was one rabbi who once commented on this particular subject in a wry observation which came to be very, very true, that he controlled a certain public institution. And he was very, very well liked because he was a very good-hearted person, a person that did phenomenal acts of charity and kindness for everyone. And very powerful and wealthy people came and wished to construct a very large edifice for his institution. And he told them, "My dear friends, I appreciate the gesture, but please don't do it for me. Because if you do it for me, one thing I am assured of is that my children will fight after my death over who is to control this. So do me a favor and don't do it." What actually did happen, that his institution was housed in really, literally a hole in the wall. When he died, though, there's a family feud which separates the family over control of this hole in the wall. So he was a lot wiser than most of us. We have the situation of Bukhara. Bukhara, according to the halacha and the Torah, are supposed to receive a double share. And it depends to a large extent how large the estate is. I mean, if one is a person of meager means, then perhaps this, in fact, his children will accept it. If one would, in fact, leave a very sizable estate and leave Pishnayim to the Bukhara, then one's asking for a lot of difficulty. I'm not advising one at this point, it's a very personal decision to do it or not to do it, but we have to realize the fact what the reasons are that we search for halachic solution, and these are things that have to be accounted for. Now, Rabbi Reis did mention before, good evening, Rabbi Schoenfeld. Rabbi Reis did mention before that we endeavor to fulfill the Torah's order of Yerusha, at least on a portion of the will. Which would mean that when we designate some percentage of the will, $5,000, $10,000, if it's a small estate, perhaps some of a larger percentage, if we're a larger estate, but take a certain portion of the will, and that should be distributed totally according to halachic principles. Now, we have also the issue, which is a very sensitive and delicate issue, and that is the expectation of a husband in terms of his responsibilities to his wife, to a widow that he may leave behind. And unfortunately, this is an issue that we have to face. I mean, this is an evening devoted to geriatric situations, and those that are professionals in that field know that we have far more widows than we have widowers. And there's a particular halachic consequence of this as well. A widower, at least halachically, is children have no claim to his estate. He's alive and he still controls his estate. A widow can be placed in the situation where her children come and in fact insist that they want a share of the estate, to divide the father's estate. There were certain protections given to a widow halachically, both by Torah law and rabbinic law. But nevertheless, I would imagine that for the average husband that is not his intention. Secondly, there may in fact be a halachic obligation to do beyond that. We have a classical statement that in the ancient times, a father did not have absolute responsibility. He was morally responsible, but legally we could not enforce upon him the obligation to support children. It reached beyond a certain age, even though they were still minors. Obviously, the community looked askance at such a person, but nevertheless, in the strict letter of the civil law, we could not force him to do so. Yet we find that a figure that lived a few centuries back, a very prolific Jewish writer called the Chidor, and the Chidor records the fact that a person is halachically obligated to support his children today, much beyond the Talmudic obligation. Why is it? Because when he ended marriage with a young woman, this was a self-understood fact that he was going to care for the children that they would have together until they reached what was the normal age in their society for them to be emancipated and go forth on their own. And we have to be concerned, in fact, that entering into marriage today, that I believe we could equally well argue that it is understood that if a widow was left behind, that she will be well taken care of, very well taken care of by the estate of the husband that she left. And then perhaps that this is an implied condition of the marriage. And this is a very tricky and difficult issue, how to fulfill this, because here we have more than one situation and more than one concern. The concern may be that a widow may survive a husband for 10, 20, or 30 years, whatever that may be, depending on the situation. The husband, though, who perhaps was most active in the commercial affairs of the family throughout the life, nevertheless has particular concerns for his children that he does not wish to forego. And as much as he loved his wife, but his wife's aunt, or his wife's sister, or his wife's niece is of no particular concern of his. I mean, he may or may not have it. His concern is that ultimately, when the time comes that his estate is finally left to his children, that he wants it to go where he wants it to go, and not now to be considered part totally the possession of his wife, and that it should now go to her heirs, who have allahu no basis for this. It's a very, very tricky problem, and needs a great deal of work. There is written information in the contemporary post-Kumar Moshe Feinstein about how to handle it, but it is a very tricky area to deal with. And I dealt with a very wealthy individual who has a very significant estate to be concerned about. And despite the fact that he can afford to pay very, very good lawyers, but they eventually despaired of trying to coordinate the secular will and the halachic will together in this particular area. So it's an area where if one has significant assets and significant concerns over the long run, if one has enough money that one feels that the likelihood is that even if he survived by his wife for 20 or 30 years subsequent to his passing, that there will still be a significant estate, and he wants at that time that it should be take care of his children and his grandchildren, this needs a great deal of thought and a great deal of planning. Do not leave this to chance. This is an area which is a very difficult and tricky area to work out properly, but one that needs a great deal of thought. Now, Rabbi Reis did mention, and I want to mention in this regard, there are different suggestions of how to go about creating the halachic will. Rabbi Reis, in fact, brought us from what I feel is the most effective and the best particular approach. Some may tell you, if you go to consult with them, that you should merely undertake to give a gift in whatever manner that you feel is appropriate, that 1 minute before the death of the person that has signed the will, he wishes to give this amount of money to this son, and this to this daughter, and this to this grandchild, etc., which halachically would work, but is not as effective as the means outlined by Rabbi Reis for a very simple reason. And that is that one, halachically, I can only transfer possession of that which I actually have at a particular moment. Suppose, in fact, that I am owed money, and I don't have that money now, and I hope that at some time in the future someone's going to pay me back. It's very, very difficult to transfer that to someone else. Now, in fact, I may have assets which are going to accrue to me in the future, return on investments that I have, for example, which may ultimately, right now, I can't even take the money out of those investments. And there's no way legally or halachically that I could transfer them to anyone else. And in the interim, they will accrue additional income and assets, which I wish, in fact, to include in the estate. And therefore, this particular method outlined by Rabbi Reis, where, in fact, I state that in the secular sense, for example, let's say I want one quarter of the will to go to each of my children at the time that the will is to be enforced, and otherwise I obligate myself to give $20 million to my great-nephew, this has the advantage that it is not limited by that particular moment that's found in the estate, at the time when the will actually be probated, and by that point the estate is accounted for. So even assets which have accrued to the estate subsequent to the death of the individual would in fact be affected in this particular matter. So it is an important consideration. This, I believe, halachically, after a great deal of research, is in fact the best method. Now, another point that Rabbi Reis did mention, in life we try to do things the right way, but we don't always succeed. For whatever reason, but we're not always successful in doing things the right way. Rabbi Reis has suggested to us accurately the right way of doing things. What happens, though, if I am involved in a situation where there was no halachic will executed, and there was only a secular will executed? Now, where do we go from there? And this is a matter of contemporary halachic dispute, and different rabbinic forums would reach different determinations in this matter. So do not despair. And then I'd be overly hopeful. This is something that's a problem that one has to deal with. I'm presently involved in a situation where this, with a person that's trying to probate an estate, and he has dealing with this particular problem. It's a tricky problem, but he's slowly winding his way through it. And it's again a problem where, with good advice, if one knows the right direction to take, one may be halachically successful in arriving even in that situation with a proper resolution. But again, in life, we don't like to do things with one hand behind our back. So why should we, in fact, burden those that we wish to receive our estate with an additional problem beyond the normal problems that are associated with it? I mentioned before the necessity of, in some way, some place, it doesn't have to be included in the will itself, but there should be some place among our important papers where there's really an accounting of what's in the estate. Because this will prevent a great deal of dispute later. Did somebody go and steal cash? Was the $200,000 cash in the safe deposit box that nobody knows about? And the fellow that had the key took it and pocketed it. One of three bank accounts in Texas that I don't know about, and he just took the bank books and ran away with them and never told us about them. These things that go on every single day. So a good accounting of the estate will help to keep family peace. A house, which is a very, very essential, not only for many people is it their largest single asset, but it's also a very essential asset in terms of the fact that a widower wants to keep living in that house and to make sure that no one else has claimed to remove them from the house is very, very important. It is typically done today. It is a very wise course of action, and it would be recognized both in the secular and in the religious law. And that is if the name of both spouses should be on the deed. If the name of both spouses is on the deed, that has very, very great standing in the halachic system. And therefore, one would be very, very hard-pressed, even if there's such a terrible family dispute that children would want to dispossess the mother, they would not succeed in a situation where a name were on the deed of the house. It's very, very, it's very easy, often early in life, to overlook. But it's a very, very important step, and one that we should be very, very careful about. Just want to mention one other type of situation. It's a common situation, and with that I will conclude my remarks. And oftentimes, late in life, we're dealing with the fact of what to deal with a parent who becomes elderly. Not such a simple task. Baruch Hashem, the world of medicine has provided us with the fact that you can have parents that live till 80, till 90, till close to 100. I have, Baruch Hashem, I have an elderly mother myself. And at times, one reaches a point in life that it's not the best situation for them to go on living on their own. They may not necessarily need the types of professional facilities that were outlined previously in the program. And oftentimes in life, what will happen is that a parent will then buy a two-family house together with one of their children and live in very close proximity to them, so they're never totally on their own. Yet they have their own privacy and their own dignity. And it's often a very fine arrangement, which, if done with seichel, works very well. But in terms of the estate aspect of it, one has to be very, very careful as well. What will be the disposition of this asset upon the passing of the parent? How exactly will the other children share or not share it? And if we don't stop to think about it beforehand, we're headed for a lot of grief. So this is something that has to be thought through and delineated before one actually undertakes this step. Because otherwise, 20 years later, 30 years later, everyone's going to come. One set of children broke their back. Their mother lived with them and they cared for them through all the difficulties, through her infirmity, etc. But after may have asked them, nobody wants to know about that anymore. All they know is that there's money, there's an asset that was left over. Listen, your kindness and your chesed, they tell you the Rebbeinu Shalom should pay you for that. But in this world, when it comes to dollars and cents, we have some other ideas. So please pay more for that. And Be'ez Hashem, we should be blessed, in fact, that we should plan well for these things. But we should live to see many, many descendants before these actually become relevant. All of us stay in good health today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Welcher, for your practical habracha. Our next speaker...